Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentzius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, contributing editor Chris Schmidt speaks with Dr. Rip McAdams of William & Mary regarding dismissal of counseling students for program violations. Dr. McAdams tells the story of how his program dealt with such a case and steps counseling programs can take to respond to problem student situations.
Okay, well, welcome Dr. Charles McAdams of the College of William & Mary. For this podcast, I'm Chris Schmidt, a doctoral student here at the College of William & Mary in the Counselor Education Program, and we're interviewing, or I'm interviewing, Dr. Charles Rip McAdams, who has been a professor here at the college for 13 years. Dr. McAdams teaches theories of counseling and psychotherapy, family counseling. He teaches the supervised practicum in agency counseling, as well as the internship, and teaches advanced counseling theories. His experience, a lot of his experience, has been working in residential settings and doing family therapy. And his research has focused on supporting counselors who work with difficult populations, those in crisis, suicide, and aggression. And so that's just a little bit of what Dr. McAdams has done. And so we're really glad that you're here for this interview.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. And in particular, this podcast today is focused on something that happened at the college a few years back. That's something you presented on at ACES this past year, and it sounds like something that a lot of counselors and counselor educators have really taken an interest to, and it's about a court challenge of the counselor education program by an enrolled student, and kind of what happened there, how it went, and just kind of your reflections on it. So what we'd like to do today is just talk about the relevance of the topic and about the dilemma that counselor education programs face, and what were the strengths and weaknesses to the school's response, and your reflections on the process generally. So again, thanks for being here. I didn't know if you had any opening comments.
No, I think it's a very pertinent topic, and we shared it at ACES last year because it we felt like it was so pertinent, and we had such a large response of after making additional information available to participants in that workshop. We had such a large response that we felt that there was a strong interest, and that if there were any other ways that we could make it available, the information that we learned available to other institutions and faculty members, that it would be useful.
Okay, that's great. Well, I guess I wanted to start with the dilemma that you talk about that counselor education programs are faced with. So can you talk a little bit about the ethical obligations programs have to identify students that are unfit for practice?
I don't think I'm talking to anybody who isn't aware that one of our roles as counselor educators is being gatekeepers to the field, and that is being gatekeepers and those who screen individuals who we think are and are not ready or prepared or capable of being professional counselors. We all are held to several standards for that gatekeeping role. KCREP, for one, in our accreditation body, require that we conduct a developmental assessment of every student, of a student's progress in the program, and that includes personal development as well as academic development. The ACA is more specific with that in its ethical standards. It requires that counselor educators and counseling programs assist students in securing remedial assistance when they have problems, but it goes one step further to say that their responsibility also lies in dismissing those students if they are not responsive to remedial action that's taken. And then finally, for counseling supervisors, ACES, is very similar in that it requires that supervisors have a responsibility for providing remedial assistance to students that are not performing up to the standards that they professionally feel are necessary for professional counselors. And once again, it uses the word screening in its standards, that they screen from the programs those students who are not, again, in their professional judgment, ready to or able, capable of being professional counselors. So we have a strong mandate to do so, to do that. We also know that we live in a very litigious environment right now, lots of chances for lawsuits, and anybody can sue. And so we, given that, we know that if we dismiss a person who's made an investment in a program, the possibility of a lawsuit always exists. And that's the double-edged sword that we sometimes speak about, that we would like to avoid a lawsuit, but we can't avoid that if we have a mandate to act on situations that we don't feel students are qualified to be counselors.
It puts you in a difficult situation, it sounds like.
It puts all of us in that situation, and it for that reason, it puts some expectations and some requirements on us that we all need to be aware of when we work with students in our programs, and keeping that in mind, that we need to be preparing for that possibility at all times.
Okay. There's a lot that goes into this case and kind of what happened step by step, and I know it's probably difficult to run through the whole thing, but if you could just kind of go through the basis and the process for starting at the dismissal decision, kind of how this happened with this particular student and what the how the counseling program responded and what led up to this court case.
Well, I'll have to take it back a little bit further than the dismissal decision, because that has a bearing on how the decision was handled and how the decision was made. It really, it was a period of about a year-long period that the issue began. We had a student in our program, a student just ending her second year in her practicum experience, who was performing at the practicum site. We received a call from the practicum site that the student's performance, in fact, that there had been some potential misconduct at the site, which involved the solicitation of individual clients from groups at the site. Because her practicum required that she have individual as well as group experience, all students had to find sites that provided both of those experiences. It appears that the student in this case was not going to have the opportunity for the individual experience, so there was an effort made on that student's behalf, or not on her behalf, by the student to solicit those individuals from the groups. And with some promises being made to the clients that they would have more confidentiality in an individual session. In other words, it was really marketing some individual clients from the group, and the group was obvious, or the site was obviously concerned about that. So that's where it all began. There were a number of calls that were made between supervisors and the site at that time. I was not the direct supervisor. I was the student's advisor, academic advisor. But one of our professional faculty members was the supervisor and made several calls to the site to follow up on the concerns. And the concerns were that the site was actually wanting to dismiss the student from the site because of their concerns of what they termed as misconduct at that site. So we determined that in order to work with the site, that terminating the student from that site was a good idea, that we would do that. After we heard the concerns, we then also agreed with the site that there appeared to be some misconduct, but also, Chris, realized that this student was at the end of her second semester and that there was certainly the possibility that the misconduct was due to lack of information, lack of knowledge about the field.
Not being prepared or not knowing yet.
Right, not knowing. So that while all students are required to study the ethical standards, they're still new. So it was our intention at this point. We had in place a professional performance review system. And that's an important part of this, that is part of our normal process of working with students. They're introduced to that professional performance review system at the beginning of their term in their student handbooks. They can see the terms that actually spells out what might happen. It spells out first that they'll be evaluated not only academically, but on their professional performance, non-academic professional performance. And then if there is a deficit in performance, it spells out what will happen, including the potential for dismissal if remedial efforts don't take effect, if they're not successful. In the case of this student, we clearly felt that remedial action was necessary. We felt that dismissal was not an issue. It was the first offense, as it were. So we developed a remedial plan for that student that involved, one, her stopping her practicum. She had to discontinue the practicum. She was required to not resume the practicum until she had completed the ethics course that we have, and sometimes they're not concurrent. The student also was required to meet with her advisor, and that's how I got involved, on a monthly basis to review her progress and make sure that there was feedback being given on a regular basis as to progress on the remedial plan. Okay. So that was the next step in the event. During the coming month, during the coming probably about 5 weeks, there was continued evaluation according to that plan of the student's behavior, but rather than accept the remedial plan, this student chose to look, it appeared, as though she had been victimized by us and that we were attempting to do something to her rather than something for her. Mm-hmm. So she attempted to speak out with her peers and with other university officials about the unfairness of the actions that we had taken. During that time that she was in fact talking to other folks and really in some ways rousing other folks to her cause, to her issue about our unfairness, I was meeting with her regularly as we had planned and reminding her that she had specific expectations that she had been given to remediate her behavior, and that by her actions of not focusing on those and focusing on the unfairness to her, that she was actually not fulfilling the remedial plan and she needed to focus on that. But that was to no avail. So our policy states that if a student receives one citation, which this student received for the action, the initial action, that if there are subsequent citations, then that then takes her to another level, takes the student to another level on the remedial plan. Towards the end, in about a month, a little bit over a month, the student actually, because of the behaviors that I just described, the student was actually cited again by two additional faculty for not fulfilling the terms of the remediation plan, and in fact, increasing the anxiety of other students about the unfairness of faculty and really developing what this student called a case against the faculty. At that point, because of the failure to respond to remediation, the faculty then, as the policy calls for, we met to consider the case and our next course of action. And it was at that meeting that the faculty made a decision to recommend dismissal of the student in accordance with the remedial plan and the standards that I talked about earlier.
Okay.
And so that's when the decision was made. We did not make the decision. We then recommended that to the administration. The associate dean, who then considered the plan, recommended that, again, after review, agreed with our recommendation, then recommended that, our recommendation to the dean, passed our recommendation to the dean of the School of Education, who, after requesting some additional information about the case, ultimately made a decision to dismiss the student.
Okay.
So that's the background on the case.
And it sounds like the dean gave the student the opportunity to be heard by the dean.
Right. The dean took two actions. Upon getting the request for dismissal of the student, she first asked me, as the advisor in the case, to provide her with a chronology of events that occurred leading up to the dismissal and any information that would substantiate the faculty's decision so that she had a clear picture of what was happening from our end. She then agreed to, or didn't agree to, she then called for a meeting with the student to discuss and get the student's ideas and perspective on the case. And it was after those two actions that she determined that she would go with the faculty's recommendation.
Okay. It also kind of sounds, you talked about the professional performance review and initially reviewing it and coming up with a few things that, that this student wasn't meeting. And then it sounds like after the requirements of the remediation plan weren't really being fulfilled, some other professional performance things started popping up as well.
Well, our professional performance review standards, there are actually 10 of them, and I guess there's not time to go through them here, but non-academic professional performance issues, ours include such things as being aware of your own impact on others, cooperation, openness to new ideas. It was almost impossible. The idea of the remediation plan was to have the student very specifically know what she needed to do differently in this case to meet the standards, our professional performance standards, and there were several of those. One of the most important being for her to be attuned to ethical behavior. That was one, which was one of the original issues that came up. The next issue, or another one, was to be aware of the impact of her own behavior on other people, and that's a major one that, in terms of beginning to raise the anxiety of students and talk about the negatives of the program rather than working on the actual remedial issues, that what she was reminded of on a number of occasions was that she was actually violating some of the other of the 10, such as cooperation, ability to deal with conflict, and again, the ability to look at your own impact on other people, that by her response to the remedial plan, she was not only not fulfilling she was actually not fulfilling other standards, and so that she was actually creating new issues for us in terms of how she would go about dealing with an issue of conflict that we had, and that raised our concerns even higher.
So, I mean, it's amazing how much went into it already up to this point, and there really haven't been charges filed. So, I guess from there, what happened? What were the charges that the student made?
Well, from there, it takes a different turn, and I think that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in a case like this one, is that we then dismiss the student in May. And I think it was in June, and around a month later, we were then received a summons in federal court, a federal court summons. Now, being a state institution, it is proper procedure that any case against the institution would be handled in federal court since it is a representative of the state. We received a summons that outlined charges against the program, and there were actually 6 charges that were lodged against us. The first of those was breach of contract, and that was a charge that the university itself had breached the student's contract by expelling her without just cause. So a breach of contract. There was then a charge against the School of Education that is listed as tortuous interference with contract, which meant that the School of Education, by giving false information, interfered with the contract that the university had with the student. So then there was that charge against the School of Education. There was a charge at both levels, School of Education and university, that there was a link between, a causal link between the supervision the student received and the action that was taken. In other words, that the constitutional injury that she had suffered was due to negligent supervision on the part of both the university and the School of Education. And then there were 2 due process charges. One was the procedural due process, which is the 14th Amendment, or the opportunity to be heard, that she had been expelled without being given an opportunity to be heard, which is a denial of her constitutional right. And then there was a denial of substantive due process, and that essentially speaks to dismissal that is motivated by ill will or bad faith. And so that was the fifth charge. And the sixth charge was one of conspiracy, and that was that the defendants in the case had conspired to deprive her of her constitutional rights, that we'd worked together as a university and school of education to deprive her of her rights.
Okay. And it's, I mean, what were your feelings when that came across to you?
Well, obviously their dismay is the best word. And I think not surprise, given that we live in such a litigious society. It wasn't surprise, but it was one of a real dismay and one of concern. Because when we talked earlier about the double-edged sword, the of being caught between the legal aspect and the requirements that we do this, there was real concern about. There was certainly, whenever you receive a summons, there's no idea where the court is going to go with that. And so what began to grow and within all of the faculty was the notion or the knowledge that this was really going to put that to the test in a way that we would much have more regretted. We regretted that that would happen, but we also knew that it was a possibility.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess when these charges were made, exactly who were they made towards, and who were the defendants in the case?
No, that was a surprise when we got it. It was surprising that it was much broader than we anticipated. There were a number of defendants named originally in the suit. One was our rector and board of visitors at the university level. Our president was named in the suit as a defendant in the case. Certainly the dean and the associate dean of the School of Education were named specifically in the initial summons. The instructor of the practicum course, the person that I spoke earlier that had worked with the site in talking about the original charges, was named in the suit. There was also a doctoral student who was assigned as a teaching assistant to that instructor for the course. That doctoral student, because of the direct supervision role that he had, was also named as a defendant in the course. And then the academic advisor, which was me, was named specifically. So all of those were named. A very broad constituency of defendants.
And no other faculty members? Does it sound like faculty really came together on some of these decisions? It doesn't sound like they were necessarily defendants.
No,
or did you represent the faculty?
Yeah, in this case, the academic advisor represented the faculty. Our course instructor was a professional faculty member. That is, she was not a tenure line faculty member. So I represented the five tenure line faculty at the university.
Okay. So, it's to all these people, you receive all these the charges. I mean, what sort of things did you have to go into as far as preparing yourself for a case like this?
Well, we were certainly, because we're a state organization, we were provided legal representation by the Commonwealth. And so we had an attorney assigned to our case, and so there was a lot of work there's a lot of work that went around to the specific charges that were lodged against us.
Okay. Can we go back and talk a little bit about those specific charges?
They listed as demands that came. I guess when you asked how we felt about it, Chris, those are always sort of startling and shocking when you get them too, but simply because they're demands against you.
Yeah.
But there were actually six of those. What the student was demanding from a legal standpoint was first that there be what's called injunctive relief or declaratory and injunctive relief of her situation. And what that actually meant was that she was seeking reinstatement immediately in the program.
Okay.
That is relief of the problem so that she could continue immediately and not fall behind. So she was looking for that first. There was also a demand for compensatory damages that would be proven at the amount of the trial, damages for whatever costs would be incurred or loss of income might be incurred as a result of the charges and the trial itself. There was there was a demand for punitive damages that would also be proven at the trial, and of course those are damages against the college and school of education for taking the action that it did. There was a demand from the student's attorney that the cost of the suit, including all of the attorney's fees, be paid by the university. And then there was also a clause, interestingly, there was a clause for any other relief as might become evident. Essentially, the student was attempting to make sure that all costs that were incurred by any aspect of this case were paid by the university. There was also a demand for a jury trial in the case, and that was actually upheld, that this did end in a jury trial.
Any reason why that would have been of a demand that you can think of?
I don't have the legal background to really know that, except that I think that it was a request for the public to hear this. I think the students hoped that the public hearing this case would see the unfairness that she had suffered allegedly, and that there would be a better chance of, but that's only speculation. That may also be standard procedure in a case of this type. That might be something that the attorney put in there, but it's actually going to happen anyway. I don't know.
Okay. So your defense as a program, kind of the preparations for the case and what you needed to do before entering the courtroom.
Well, that's a long process, and there's a period, and again, without being a lawyer, there were several things that happened. First, there was a long period there were several months of discovery, and discovery is the period where there's gathering of information by both the defendants and the plaintiff's attorneys. And the information that's gathered is documentation. I'm fortunate to say that our administrative office and the associate dean in particular handled most of the gathering of the documents. And when I talk about documents, they are essentially documents that have anything to do with, in this case, the student's role in the program, admission to the program, evaluation in the program, and of course anything that had to do with communications relating to the dismissal decision, and including communications between faculty and administration about that. So there was an enormous body of documentation that had to be gathered, that was demanded by the plaintiff for us to be sent. And that's actually physically getting that together and sending it. And there's typically about a 30-day period for gathering that information. And then there's also, for the defense, our own attorneys needed to get information as well. Mm-hmm. Also included in that is depositions. Depositions are actually physical interviews taken by the plaintiff and the defense to gather more information that they need for the case from those people involved, defendants and plaintiffs. They can go as long as 7 hours each. I know that my own was about 7 hours, and I think most other folks were about the same. So there were, again, an enormous number of hours of personal time put into doing these different interviews on the part of that. After that documentation is received, then it's reviewed by both sides, and then both sides have another period to see if they've got what they need, to ask for additional information or clarification on the information. So a number of months can go by with that. But again, I think that from the administrative standpoint, the amount of hours that went into that would be considerable.
Yeah, it sounds like. I mean, very big chunks of time getting together those documents. I think, I saw somewhere that it was over 1,000 pages.
Easily.
That together. Yeah. And all that time that faculty and administrators are spending outside of the classroom, outside of the school to do this, all before entering the actual courtroom.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing easy or quick about it. And it's one thing I'll say, and I might have an opportunity to speak a little bit more to that later on, but having the documentation, the fact that the documentation was required is in and of itself a message to all of us to make sure that we have documentation, yeah. because it is documentation that the court seeks to substantiate any claim on either side. So the documentation is essential.
Okay. So I guess that kind of brings us up to the courtroom and what happened in the trial and what kind of came out of it.
Well, let me speak before I say that, because it really did, and there was another step there, and that would be that in gathering that documentation, there was a defense developed that we took into the courtroom with us. And there were a number of items. Actually, there had to be a response made in writing to each of the claims that were made by the plaintiff. And they're actually fairly extensive, so I can't go into them all here, but I can just brief those. One of the things that happened is that the judge in this case looked over the charges and made a decision without jury involvement as to the validity of the different charges that were there. And several of the charges were thrown out. They were actually not taken as viable, and so that they were eliminated from that. Two of those were the charge that we had that there'd been a conspiracy. The judge determined that there was not a conspiracy of the university against the student, that it actually that there appeared that there was actually collaboration, but that wasn't, there was no evidence to support the fact that it was malicious in favor of the student. There had been collaboration there around that. There was a the contract charge was also eliminated because there was no evidence to substantiate that there is any contract that is between a student and a university that that infallibly or that can say that a student will graduate from the program. That's a professional judgment issue, so that was thrown out. There was also the supervisory liability charge was eliminated. And there was no evidence, again, and I'd say that the reason these are eliminated is that's because that there's no evidence to support that on the judge's decision, that there was any evidence that there was a causal link between supervision on the university's part and the decision that was made with the student. So first of all, there were some of the charges were eliminated for those reasons. What that really left us with was the due process charges. And those are considerable charges in the sense that the procedural due process says that, at least that's the charge that said that the student did not have an opportunity to be heard. And then there was the substantive charge of ill will that had to be proven in the court.
Okay.
So those were the two that we went into the courtroom primarily with. I might also add that the 11th Amendment, in terms of having liability, the 11th Amendment actually protects a state organization from being sued in the carrying out its prescribed process. So the 11th Amendment protected the university against the charge of supervisory liability.
Okay. So it's from starting at six charges, it dropped down to three, mm-hmm. it sounds like. Okay. So at this point, you're heading into court.
Mm-hmm.
Are we there?
I think we are.
Okay.
We were, court began on a Thursday. The court seems to be able to know about how long a case will take, a jury trial. And of course, we had to go through the process of jury selection, and that's time consuming. But the plan was that we would be in court for 2 days, but there's no input on that. But just the assumption of our attorney was that it would be at least 2 days and possibly go into the next week with that. So I believe court started on a Thursday, and court started with the presentation of the plaintiff's case, not ours. And so the plaintiff's attorney, the student's attorney, presented her case and called all of her defendants. That included all of course, all of the defendants in the case. I called all of her witnesses, excuse me, and that included all the defendants in the case to do actual court testimony. And so everyone who was named, and that went up to, in terms of the defendants, I think I'd mentioned before that the president and the provost and the top administration of the university were not involved. But from the dean, the associate dean, all the faculty involved, myself, all did live testimony in the courtroom and underwent both examination and cross-examination by the two attorneys. And actually, interestingly, the testimony in court was very similar to the interviews that we had done with the attorneys before and doing the depositions, where they were very specific. Obviously, in cross-examination, they were very pointed, the case being that we had not or that they were pointed towards trying to show that the faculty had not followed due process, that they had not given the student an opportunity to either remediate her behavior or to state her or to have her case heard before the decision was made. And so very pointed in that direction, and sometimes very painful, because you don't have the opportunity in court to say but. You can only listen and say yes or no, and so sometimes, even though you think things are misconstrued, you don't have the opportunity to change that. So it can be, you wonder if a jury is hearing, you know, how it really is.
But. Right. Did you guys, I mean, as a faculty or as defense, did you feel confident going into this? I mean, what were the?
It's interesting, Chris. The answer to that is no, we didn't feel confident. I think any time you go into a jury trial, for the reasons I was just talking about, yeah, you really don't feel confident. On the other hand, I want to say that we felt committed. I think there was a clear commitment among the faculty, and we would have not taken the decision. While I may have been a spokesperson for faculty, this was a faculty decision that we met on several occasions and talked very carefully about. And there was a commitment to the case. Our associate dean, it is standard procedure in a lawsuit of this type for the plaintiff to ask the defendants if they want to settle, if they want to settle out of court. Settlement for us would have meant not going to court, but it would have meant reinstating the student in the program. In other words, retracting our original decision. And I know that when we as a faculty were asked, according to that standard procedure, if we would do so, we unanimously agreed that we could not do that. We felt, and it was really our feeling, that the only thing worse than going to court would have been violating our commitment to the field and allowing a student that we did not feel was capable of being productive in that field or productive to clients to move forward. So we didn't go in confident. We went in with commitment and with a lot of fear.
Yeah, because there was a lot at stake.
A lot at stake. I to this day sometimes cringe to think what would have happened if the outcome had been different than it was. You know, what would that have meant? The implications for not just us, but for the field would have been tremendous. Again, going back to the double-edged or to the standard that we are mandated to uphold.
Yeah. So it sounds like from that the outcome was positive for the university.
In the end, it was, yes. Not without, some work in the courtroom, but yes, it was.
So did the trial go, did it go all the way, or?
No. There are, I might mention that along the way, there were requests from our attorney to the court to dismiss the case on the matter of summary judgment, and that's essentially asking the judge to dismiss the case on the grounds that there's not sufficient evidence to continue with a trial. Twice that was denied. So if you asked if we went in with confidence, that's one of the reasons that we didn't. But what that meant was the judge did not, he did feel that certainly the three charges that we talked about were viable charges that did warrant being heard further than a summary judgment would have. The court proceeded for 2 days, and at the end of the second day, or towards the afternoon of the second day, the plaintiff, the student's attorney, ended their case. They ended their testimony. At that point, it would have been then our attorney's time to start the presentation of our case, which clearly would have taken us into the following week. So we would have been talking multiple days. At that point, however, our attorney filed for a dismissal of the case as a matter of law. That is similar to a summary judgment, but it only happens in the courtroom, and it happens typically in a jury trial, where what it essentially means, now I'm not an attorney, I was told these things, but what that actually means is that our attorney suggested that as a matter of law, there wasn't sufficient evidence to warrant the further continuation of a jury in the consideration of this case. The result was actually that's what happened. The judge determined at that time, we took a recess. The judge returned, and at that time asked that they leave the courtroom, and then he made a decision at that time that as a matter of law, there wasn't sufficient evidence that a jury really could, in his terms, in his opinion, have found for the plaintiff in the case. At that time, he dismissed the jury and ended the case.
So, I mean, that's definitely a positive outcome for the university and the program and the field. And I guess looking back on this process, it sounds like was it over a year, all of this?
Yeah. If you look at the time that it actually, the whole thing began, starting with the initial call from the site in February, and it went until August of the following year. So it went over a year, the entire process.
So that's, taking up a lot of time and resources and time away from students, time away from research, time away from teaching. And that must have been difficult.
Yeah, one of the things that we learned, we had some time, we've had a lot of time to reflect on this, and I guess that's the part that if anything is important in this whole process, it's important to share that, what we did. And there were a couple of things that we had some specific things that we did right and wrong that might be useful, but in a more general sense, in relation to what you're saying, Chris, we realized that there really wasn't a sense of victory. There was a sense of relief that it was over. Nobody won. We hated it. We didn't dismiss the student. We don't admit students with the idea that they're not going to finish. We admit students because we want them to succeed. And the fact that this student's trajectory through our program ended in this way was by no means a victory for us. If anything, it's a failure for us, because we certainly wish that we could have done more initially, perhaps, to either screen the student in the beginning if we felt that the student wasn't able to succeed, or to have been more successful with our remedial plan. But at any rate, so it wasn't a victory, but we felt relief. A couple of other things that we discovered, we really discovered that the mandates that we have that I talked about in the beginning, they're not easy to defend, because this is not a subjective work. It relies heavily on professional judgment. Mm-hmm. And in our case, the judge clearly made it clear that he respected that professional judgment, and in this case, based his decision on, I think to a large part, that professional judgment that was made by faculty who have years of training and years of experience. And for that played into that relief. We learned that a lot of people were hurt by this, and I can talk more specifically if you'd like about that, but we learned that lots of folks were hurt. When I say hurt, it didn't do any good for anybody. And that when people were hurt, it shook the stability of other students in the program, partially, Chris, because it took away from the time that we would have had with them in doing other things. So it clearly impacted our program. And so they couldn't have been getting our 100% when it was being given so much to the court process. Right. Certainly it hurt the student, I'm sure, the plaintiff herself, who couldn't continue the program. Not that we could have changed it, but to this day we still feel that if we could have just had a remedial plan where the student complied, we wouldn't have been there. So the student got hurt in terms of her forward movement that she desired. And then the faculty, I think we all continued to second guess and to ourselves, but more than that, the time that we would have for creativity and spontaneity and doing the things that really bring a program alive, I'm certain were restricted during that period of time. There were tremendous costs, you know, and those costs are part of those costs are the hurts, but there were costs in terms of time, in terms of administration, in terms of money. Yeah. That, of course, we didn't have to shell out, but someone did for the price of a court suit. And then we, I guess the last thing that we really learned was the firsthand importance of being very, very careful in the beginning in your admissions process and to the best of your ability, trying to find those students that you think can succeed and trying to avoid the need for remediation, but more than that, the need to end up as we did. Because it's just not a winner.
Being put in the position that you
right.
ended up being in. I think you touched on some of them right there, but I was interested in, I know at your presentation you talked about the strengths and the weaknesses that you felt the school had in responding to this. And I was wondering if you could kind of frame that in suggestions for other programs, you know, just in preparation for, not that it's going to happen, no one wants it to happen, but if something like this were to happen at another college or university, the type of things that they might want to look out for
mm-hmm.
or prepare themselves
for. I want to end on a high note, so I'll start with what we did wrong, and the list okay. are fairly equal, actually, of things that we found out. Certainly we did some things right. At least because in this case, at least our mandate was upheld. So I think we consider that to be, we did some things, but we did do some things in reflection, and we've had some time to reflect now that we did do wrong. And one of the things that we did is that we realized that there had been some behavior, some incidents with this particular student prior to, with other faculty had had some incidents, some indicators, some warning signs that there might be some problems prior to the actual concern that was brought to our attention that were dealt with informally by faculty rather than using the formal professional performance review protocol. That's a human nature type of thing, I think. We want to sort of not make a mountain out of a molehill. But we learned that it probably pays. It probably is good for everybody involved, including the student concerned, if we make formal our concerns. We bring them to light. We specify them. We make sure that everybody's clear on what they were. Because if you asked earlier, did we go in with confidence, I think that our feeling of confidence as to our position could have been much stronger if some of that information, some of that had been able to show that we'd had a pattern of behaviors as opposed to this one event. I think so there would have been opportunities for earlier possible remediation with the student on a formal basis if we don't take that mountain out of a molehill concern. So okay. I think utilizing your protocol when you need it is okay. important. We didn't have in that protocol, we didn't have a clause for misconduct, for crisis type behaviors. We said if you do this, if you get a citation, then one thing will happen. If you get another citation, then another thing, and it led up like that. There wasn't a clause for something that really skipped the first level and went to the second level, that actually looked at the possibility of dismissal immediately, such as something that would put in the danger of clients or others or the well-being of clients or others in danger. And so we felt that needed to be added, that there needs to be a clause that allows you to intervene at higher levels in your protocol. Okay.
Something more serious right. than expected.
And something that, again, that risks the well-being okay. of your clients. One thing that I didn't mention in this is that the faculty who was involved, the professional faculty member who worked directly with the student, felt that because of the dishonesty that appeared to have occurred in trying to solicit the clients at the site, initiated an honor council violation charge with the university towards the student. That process ran concurrent with the lawsuit during the time, and I could spend a lot of time on that, but actually that is really a process where the student is judged by a jury of peers on that. We found that was actually confounding and confusing, particularly for the court, to separate the two. The faculty did not take that action. That was simply action taken by the supervisor working directly with the student. But the court certainly found it difficult to that action. Typically, the Honor Council action is disciplinary action, and whereas the faculty action was remedial action, and the court found it difficult to separate the two because of the concurrent cases running. So I can't say that I would recommend not taking Honor Council action if Honor Council action is warranted, but be prepared to explain the difference between remedial and disciplinary measures taken, right, and who's taking them. So, we, in hindsight, certainly the court felt that it was sufficient, but we lack specificity, I think, in definitions of our criteria for professional performance. We listed, for example, cooperation. Since then, we've developed a rubric that says what acceptable and non-acceptable cooperation is, and we did that for all 10 of our criteria. It was sufficient for what we needed here, but I think that were we to be in the same situation again, or just making sure that students know what we mean, right, we have taken a step since then to better explain what those criteria mean,
really, and to specify them.
Them very, very specifically, actually, okay, in that. One of the things, and this is probably one of the major things, Chris, that we did, is that our faculty, one of the reasons that we knew that students were being hurt by the plaintiffs, the other students' behavior, is that other students were coming forward with fears about their own security in the program. When students would come forward, as students, I think, should be expected to be, they were very hesitant to come forward against one of their peers, because it's one of their peers and because it's ratting on a peer. But after their feelings got strong enough and bad enough, they did come forward, sometimes with the stipulation that they not be identified. Our faculty agreed with them on that, not thinking about court at that point, but our faculty said, I will not talk to anybody else about that if you'll just go ahead and tell me that. As it turns out, that's a promise you can't keep. Because once you go to court, you are required to submit the names, specific names, of all sources of information, which required us to have to go back to our students and retract our promise. Most of them understood that, but it certainly would have been better in the beginning to say that if you come forward, you have to realize that I may or may not be able to maintain your confidentiality. And that hurts sometimes to have to do that, but they seem to handle that well. The other thing is that we didn't require the plaintiff's signature on every document, every formal document. And our formal documents are all documents related to the professional performance review citation policy, or any letters that might be given to the student providing guidance. Important, we think, to always provide signatures on documentation, because that is proof that the person who you say has received information has received it. Okay. It makes it sometimes seem unduly formal unduly formal, but in the end, it's probably the best way to go to make sure that everybody's clear on expectations. Yeah. So that's what we did. Those are the things that we did wrong.
That you're still improved. I mean, that you improved on. That you wish would have been better at the time, but that you've improved on.
We've improved on a lot of those, and I think we use those as a guide. And I might say that the thing, and there was, but there were some things that I can thank our preparations for our initial 1999 preparation for KCRAP. It was actually 1997-98 preparation, as helping us have that in place at the time this was there. Mm-hmm. But the things that were strong about our protocol were that one of the things is that we followed it. In handling this case, we went by the book, as it were, and that book is the student handbook, which outlines the protocol, which all students receive the first day of orientation. So we followed it. And so if you have a protocol, follow it. And some of the things I said a minute ago about the ways that we didn't do.
Yeah.
We documented most of the things we observed. If we had concerns, we used the opportunities in the protocol for documentation to do that, to do just that, to document our concerns. I would advise that to anyone involved in student professional performance evaluation, to be sure that you observe, that you document, because certainly documentation means that everyone is clear, both the person that you're concerned about and those expressing the concern about what the expectations and concerns are. From a legal standpoint, it is only the documentation that's going to hold any weight as justification for action you take in court.
Okay.
So, we developed a feasible and remedial plan. The court found in favor that our remedial plan was a viable one, that we had not asked the student to fulfill expectations that were unfulfillable or unfulfillable in the time or that she had to do them. So carefully looking at getting consultation, working as a united faculty on a remedial plan is essential.
It sounded like you were really trying to, I mean, you're really trying to help. You're really trying to help her continue as a student in a positive way.
I think nobody, Chris, ever thought when we developed the remedial plan that it would end like it did. I think we all felt that we had a problem. We looked at a solution. We presented the solution that was a doable solution, and that would be that. It was really a surprise to all of us when the problem began to escalate, and not only escalate, but to escalate in really different directions as well with the remedial plan. We gave her a realistic time frame, as the court found. I think our time frame, one of the things I will say about time frame is that, you know, in a 2-year program, there's not a lot of time. And so we'd think we'd love to have more time, but each of our semesters gives us, that's time for making different types of evaluations. And we gave the student the benefit of the entire semester to evaluate that aspect of performance and to remediate that. And there often isn't going to be as much time as we might like to have, but we gave it the maximum time that our program would allow to change a behavior within a specific aspect of the program. And I think that's something we did right, and the court supported us on. We included another thing that we did right is that we included the administration in our decisions. As a faculty, we did that collaboratively at every step of the way. I think that the most dangerous thing would be to try to move forward as a faculty without the support of your administration, or vice versa. But we were together, and I think that's essential. And if you can't get together, then it's essential that you move in a different direction, because certainly going to the level of going to court, if we had, as an administration and a faculty, not been clearly united, I believe the court would never have found in our favor on behalf of the student. I mentioned earlier that something we did right is that we documented. So a lot of that documentation was to the student. And I think one of the things that, as I look back on this and think about my own regrets about having to terminate a student, I can say with a sense of assurance that the student was given lots of feedback on both what she needed to do to correct her behavior. And it wasn't just in one time and then she didn't do it. It was along the way that she had many, many opportunities to express, to talk about the issues, to talk about the concerns that she was having, to find ways to deal with those. And she was reminded of the new issues that were found to be evolving from her position on the case. So I do take, and I think the faculty as a whole looks not with any kind of pride, not with any kind of sense of victory, but with a sense of assurance that we did the best that we could to let the student know what she was doing wrong and what she needed to do better before we made the decision. And the final thing I'll say is that I think one thing we did right is that after we carefully and collaboratively agreed that action had to be taken, that we didn't compromise on that. We didn't compromise our values. We didn't compromise the standards. We didn't settle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, if there was reason for settling, we should settle. I mean, if we weren't sure about our conviction that there needed to be the action taken, the dismissal action, then we shouldn't have taken it. But we did feel that way. We were committed to that. And I feel strongly that our decision to go to trial was a better one than settling, because we were in no way lacking unanimity in our decision of what had to be done.
Okay. It's neat how that kind of theme of unity as a faculty comes up in a few different areas of the strength, and how important that was for you guys
Unity of faculty and administration. I think that's essential in that you have both, that you work together, that you not hold any information back either way. If administration, for example, the dean, as I mentioned earlier, her final request before making the dismissal decision was to get a very clear and specific rundown of all the information from the faculty as to what had occurred, so she could be clear on that. And we gave that. And at the same time, our decision to both take remedial action, our first decision to take remedial action was actually in a meeting where the associate dean was present. I didn't mention that, but that it wasn't just the faculty doing one thing and then taking it to the administration. We asked the administration in way back in the initial point of developing remediation, we had the associate dean involved in all the decision-making processes so that he was able to hear our process as well as our outcome with that.
Okay. Well, that might be a good place for us to finish up. What's amazing to me is how it was such a comprehensive overview of all that went into this, and to really look back at how detailed a process like this can be and how important it is to do all the documentation and be together on it. And again, I think as you mentioned, how important it is to share this information, now that you're able to share it, to get it out there. And so I think there are some great benefits to hearing the process, and also hearing those suggestions and recommendations that you've been making.
Could I say one other thing about that? I think as you say that, it's true. And I think that when we presented this before, there's a hesitancy to present it because it's not something we're proud of. You know, I mean, essentially, I think I mentioned earlier, I think the fact that we ended up in court is in some ways admitting our own failure on the other end to do that. And so I want to make it clear when I present this in any case that it's not presenting it as any kind of expertise in this area. It's actually presenting something that I almost would rather painfully not present. But I do believe that the potential for this type of situation is real. And for that reason, I really do want to stress that where we as a program have probably most benefited from this is through an alertness to that need, and that need to continue to develop our preventive techniques, to our ways to both prevent students who aren't qualified to be counselors from coming into programs and helping them see other routes, and also our areas of remediation to find out how can we be more effective remediators. So, but that said, we'll continue to share experience with this because hopefully that sharing of that experience will play into it'll help folks understand the reality of it and the significance of it and the cost of it, and that may motivate their own preventive activities. So that's the reason we do it, and not for any other reason.
Well, it sounds like very beneficial to the field. So thank you, Dr. McAdams, for your time and your willingness to talk about something that isn't not necessarily proud of, but you know that is beneficial for everybody.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Rip McAdams speaking about how counseling programs can respond to student litigation. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.